Hey everyone, this is Dr. Brian Hutchison, and I am the editor of the Asia Pacific Career Development Journal, and I'd like to welcome you to our very first podcast for the journal, which we are calling Behind the Science. And so each issue, and we produce two issues per year, I will be doing a podcast with the authors of several of the articles in that issue. Today, I'm really excited to have Danielle Lefebvre with me, who is the lead author for the lead article for the March 2020 issue. And the title of this article is Workplace Experiences of Transgender Individuals, a Scoping Review. So Danielle, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, well, here's what I can tell you. You have as much experience doing this podcast as I do.
Well, that's good to know.
So, Danielle, as we talked a little bit offline, I'm really trying to sort of queue up specific information so that the readership of APCDJ gets to know you, gets to know the story of your work, and gets to know the importance of your work. And so I'd like to start off by asking, how do you describe yourself professionally?
That's a really good question. I think it's kind of funny hearing that and kind of where I'm at in my career, because I never really considered, you know, the professional side to myself. But I think what I would say is that a lot of my work as, I guess, a professional and a researcher and an academic is really with like a social justice focus, and kind of a feminist lens to really highlight the experiences of people who might be part of a like underprivileged population and what their experiences have been like, so that we kind of as a society, both globally and within a country, for example, we can help others to lessen those gaps, to lessen the discrimination and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would definitely say a lot of my research and my professional work is geared towards social justice, and really trying to highlight some of the experiences of people so that we can progress towards a more just and equal society. Yeah. And that's kind of also come up in like volunteer work and that kind of thing. So that's really been like a highlight of my professional career, I guess I would say. Okay. So, yeah.
So then when you say your professional work, you were trained as a counselor, is that correct?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, and what types of settings and what types of client populations do you have experience working with?
So I've worked a lot with like the post-secondary population, so with a lot of university students who have a variety of concerns, and gender can certainly be one of those concerns. Mm-hmm. And so kind of through that experience, I've definitely learned a lot about what might be happening like on campuses, for example, with regards to any of that like systemic discrimination or institutional discrimination. So definitely working on a campus has illuminated a lot of those concerns, I would say, and also has played into the social justice motivation for me. Yeah.
One of the things I think a lot about in my work in this space is sort of the language soup that we create. Mm-hmm. And so maybe it would be helpful to take a pause. And so together, when we use this idea of systemic oppression or bias or prejudice and institutional, are there specific examples that come to mind that you've encountered?
Yeah, so I would say the LGBTQ plus community more generally. I've seen how on campuses sometimes that there can be some discrimination and oppression on those grounds. So some examples would be there being more like inquiry and barriers in terms of organizing events for LGBTQ plus students, whereas other clubs or other groups might not have those same barriers.
And are these, I'm sorry if I interrupted, are these are these like paperwork barriers, or is it the person sitting there that might show that prejudice that's part of the bureaucracy, or what might those look like?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. I think with regards to the paperwork, there's more needing to prove why it's a good event or why it needs to be done. And then it's, of course, entirely possible that the individual person that they're speaking with is maybe has some biases that they're maybe not aware of, and that might also kind of get in the way in terms of having these events or getting that advocacy out there.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some real, I think, sort of subtle hidden systems as well. And in universities as bureaucracies, it often is the will of that person that's the gatekeeper.
Yeah.
To absolutely. Opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah.
Very good. Mm-hmm. And now I'm of the understanding that you're a doctoral student. So could you talk a little bit about that choice to enter a doctoral program and what it is that you plan to study?
Yeah, so that I decided ultimately to do a PhD because I felt like a lot of what I wanted to do was within like an academic realm, and research and that kind of thing. And so I wanted to have the opportunity to explore a little bit more about the experiences of transgender people. Mm-hmm. That was my master's thesis, and so I kind of wanted to extend that. So what I'll be looking at for my PhD thesis or dissertation is the experience of gender euphoria for transgender people. So it takes a bit of a different approach to understanding the experiences of transgender people, in that it looks at a bit of a more positive experience and how we can encourage that rather than focusing on, you know, a lot of the not so positive experiences, I guess, which are still important.
And the term there was gender euphoria?
Euphoria, yeah.
Okay. So would you give us a layperson's definition of that? I'm guessing that most listeners are not familiar with that term. I know I'm not familiar with that term.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I hadn't heard of it either until I actually did my master's thesis. So it is a new term for me as well. It essentially refers to the joy of living as one's gender. So it's kind of considered the opposite of gender dysphoria, which is that mismatch and the disconnect and the distress that kind of comes with the body and the mind not necessarily aligning. So this looks at the joy and the comfort of being able to live as their correct gender.
Mm-hmm. That is just such a beautiful concept.
It is. It really is.
Yeah. So, and we're going to talk about your article, but there's a real strength-based tone to your article. And so this term and this focus of your research sort of orients me to your work. Where you're looking for euphoria, you're looking for a strength-based focus instead of a deficit-based focus.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Because I find that it's really important to highlight you know, some of the struggles and their experiences so that we can address that. But it's also important to look at, you know, really a lot of these strengths that they do have, and to really highlight that.
Yeah. So this seems like a good segue. One of the questions I want to ask in all of these podcasts is to tell me the story of your article. And for the listening audience, I'm not asking you to review the article, but to tell me from the earliest seed that was planted in your mind until the writing of the article, how that came about.
Yeah, so it kind of, as we talked about before, it was originally for a class I was taking, a career counseling class, with Jose, actually, the other author.
That's Jose Domine, who is an associate editor of this journal, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So he kind of introduced me to all this, which is really exciting. So basically, it started with wanting to understand the experiences of transgender people in the workplace a little bit better. Since I was doing my thesis on or with transgender people, I wanted to really immerse myself into the literature. So that's why I kind of elected to look into the experiences of transgender people in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And what I was finding was that a lot of it was very kind of negative. And certainly not to dismiss the, you know, discrimination that absolutely exists. I found that I wanted to balance it a little bit more to show that there is all this discrimination and stereotypes and biases and sometimes violence. And yet transgender people are able to push through all of it and to continue with their commitment to who they are. And I think that's really important to highlight when we talk about a lot of the discrimination or oppression that might take place, is that they are committed to themselves, they're committed to change, and that's, I think, really important to highlight because it reflects a lot of personal strength and community strength, for sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm one of our members, maybe working in India where our conference is being held virtually now this week, or maybe in Vietnam where our conference was last year, or South Korea where our current president of the association is, just to give some examples. Mm-hmm. And I don't identify as transgender, and I don't know anyone who identifies as transgender. Why would this work matter to those career professionals?
Yeah. I think it's just generally important for everyone to be aware of this, be aware of the discrimination, be aware of potentially their personal biases or their personal assumptions and stereotypes, so that if they do encounter someone who identifies as transgender, they are in a position where they can be supportive and be accepting, so that that person doesn't feel excluded or like they're being judged or like they're being oppressed. So I think it's something for us that we, especially cisgender people more generally, it's something for us to reflect on and really continue to learn about, because we do live in societies, we do live in communities, and so part of our responsibility as human beings is to support each other and to welcome each other and to make sure that everyone feels safe.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you use the term cisgender. I want to make sure for the audience, could we get a definition of that as well?
Yeah, for sure. So that's when the sex a person was assigned at birth matches their gender identity. So transgender, on the other hand, would be the sex they were assigned at birth does not match their gender identity.
Yeah.
And this is this biological sex, since you're using at birth?
Yeah, it's basically assigned based on those biological sex characteristics.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So and most often, at least in Western cultures, assigned by the doctor. Is that correct?
It is. Yeah. Yeah. That's
okay.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So in some ways, you're saying there's almost a lack of agency in choosing one's gender at mm-hmm. birth because you're a baby.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. So it kind of just gets assigned.
So I think it's important and a nice segue then to dig into the findings of your article then, because hopefully mm-hmm. the audience is sitting there thinking that your call for preparedness mm-hmm. is a call that must be answered ethically and legally as a professional. So what should people know based on the outcomes of your article?
So I think what's really important to take away is the ways in which discrimination might come up, and then also for people to reflect on the ways in which they themselves might perpetuate that discrimination. Mm-hmm. So
you know, maybe that we could start with the ways that discrimination is most often evident in the workplace. Would that be a good starting point?
For sure, yeah. So I think, as was one of the themes in this review, was that of support. So being supportive of coworkers or employees who identify as transgender, and making sure that we're using the correct pronouns, that we're using the correct name, and being generally inclusive. And also being careful not to not be supportive, I guess, which can come up in many ways. Like it can be very overt, such mm-hmm. as like verbal harassment or insults or that kind of thing, or being fired or something like that. So it's important.
We still see these awful behaviors in workplaces around the world. Is that correct?
We do, yes, okay. Yeah. So,
any ideas on like the frequency or how can we sort of hold the magnitude of that in our minds?
Yeah, so as was kind of mentioned in the paper, that it's in a lot of Asian countries more generally, it's generally quite high percentages of transgender employees who run into some kind of discrimination, whether that be verbal harassment or being fired or that kind of thing. So it is certainly a global issue. And as well, it does happen in the West, of course, a lot of those barriers, a lot of that discrimination. So the prevalence is unfortunately quite high.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and I feel like I've not been the best interviewer. So right now in my mind, we're in the middle, which is in the actual workplace, right?
Yes.
But in the paper, you also talk about even the most affirming countries mm-hmm. in Asia, in the Asia Pacific region, there's still societal level structural barriers to even yes. the type of work that you're able to do. Could mm-hmm. you talk a little bit about how we see that? I remember Thailand's a country that I'm very familiar with that you talked about in the article.
Yeah, yeah. So it's what was interesting kind of going into this research was that a lot of these countries, maybe if they're on the surface, they might seem to be quite accepting, quite safe spaces. When you really drill down to those everyday experiences, you can kind of see how a lot of transgender people are restricted to working in certain areas that are maybe deemed more acceptable for them. And they're almost, in a sense, kept from entering other sectors of work. So I think some of the examples were a lot of transgender people, especially transgender women, felt pressured to go into the entertainment industry or to work at like a hair salon or something like that. Mm-hmm. And if that's, you know, of course, what they're interested in, then that's fantastic and not a problem. The concern is that if they were kind of forced into these areas because they were not welcomed in other professions. Right. Yeah.
And correct mm-hmm. me if I'm wrong, but you're using mm-hmm. the term entertainment industry, but in many of these countries, that also means the sex industry. Is that correct?
Yeah. In a lot of countries, that does mean sex work and that kind
okay.
of thing.
Right. And yeah. so your identity as a transgender person greatly mm-hmm. limits or circumscribes the array of career possibilities. And so much so that even in some of the most inclusive societies, and I'll use mm-hmm. Thailand as the example since I've worked there quite a bit, mm-hmm. your options really are limited. And that often includes sex work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That seems to be the case. Yeah.
And that's in the most inclusive countries for transgender people. What about the least inclusive countries? And maybe here, for mm-hmm. political reasons, we don't name specific countries, but
sure.
What does it look like in the least inclusive countries?
Yeah. So it definitely is a worse kind of situation in countries where it's maybe... where they're maybe not as accepting. So some examples of that are just outright discrimination, outright verbal insults, or physical abuse even. So that can be, you know, being excluded or being shunned, both in the workplace and in society more generally. It can often... people often feel that they maybe have a right to act violently towards transgender people because they're not in line, I guess, with, you know, societal expectations.
Right.
So I would say like violence is quite a major experience in a lot of countries that maybe are a lot worse with regards to transgender people's rights and that kind of thing. And those are the countries where really a lot of them would be forced into maybe kind of criminalized professions like sex work. Mm-hmm. So that's probably where it happens the most because they're outright not allowed to enter the workforce in right. everyday professions and that kind of thing. Right. Yeah.
So far, you've really done an excellent job of sort of painting the magnitude of the problem here, right? Of a client sitting in our office as career service professionals and needing mm-hmm. our help more than just a career decision. Through your review, were you able to make any recommendations to career coaches, career counselors, human resources professionals, and what we ourselves might do, both in our workplace, but then also when working specifically with an individual client?
Yeah. So there were a few recommendations that were provided at kind of different levels. So for career counselors and also at a broader kind of policy level. So starting with kind of like career counselors, there are a lot of kind of basic counseling skills that are really important or especially important when working with transgender people. Mm-hmm. So that mm-hmm. that openness, that non-judgmental stance is incredibly important for the client to feel safe and like they can trust their counselor.
Danielle, may I ask, so I think, you know, I'm trying to put my picture in the mind of someone who's not worked with a transgender individual before. And mm-hmm. so I think one of the things that people ruminate on a lot is gender pronouns and how to determine how to have a conversation with a person, particularly when maybe you're new to working with this population. How would you coach a new counselor or a new coach to start to have those broaching type conversations around pronouns and name usage and things like that?
Yeah. I think what really helps is to be open and honest, to really convey that you're coming from a non-judgmental position and with the intention to learn and to make sure that the client feels safe. So kind of letting the client know that you have their best intentions in mind, and their best interests, I mean. So just a lot of times it's really about outright asking them, like, what are your correct pronouns? What is your correct name if it's different from what's kind of on their identification? Mm-hmm. So really just kind of being direct, but also letting them know that it's coming from a place of genuine learning and wanting care. To be supportive. Exactly. Yes. Yeah exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And would you say, is it important to do that as habit? Because I would think some might think, oh, if I suspect that someone may be transgender, I have to do it. Mm-hmm. But it may not always be obvious, or we make mistakes. Is that something that we should always be doing?
Yeah, it's something that I would say should always be done, asking for the correct pronouns, just because sometimes clients might feel uncomfortable or unsure if they should be the ones to bring it up. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's important for counselors to be the ones to broach that subject with everybody. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that, again, I may have gotten you off track. So we were talking about sort of the takeaways that a career coach or a career counselor mm-hmm. might want to observe from your work in their practice. And so we've identified sort of in the room and how to interact well mm-hmm. with clients. What are some of the other takeaways?
I think what's important as well, especially if the counselor hasn't worked with transgender clients very often, it's really important to get supervision and consult with colleagues or those who might have had more experience. Mm-hmm. And really to be engaged in some kind of learning outside of the counseling itself, just to make sure that they're approaching, you know, their client and any topics appropriately, and they're being considerate of the client's experiences.
Mm-hmm. And so now I'm going to abruptly shift. Is there anything else that our listeners should want to know, that you would want them to know about working with this population?
I think that pretty much covers it, as long as everything comes from a place of genuine caring and support of the client. I think, you know, that pretty much covers it. Yeah.
Well, so the professor nerd in me really wants to ask about the research methods as well. And so you've done something for the first time in our journal, and that many of our listeners may not be familiar with, but this technique of a scoping review. So would you describe, why a scoping review for this particular paper? And then how do you do that? What's your 60-second commercial on this is how to do a scoping review?
Yeah, so scoping reviews are a little bit different than, say, like a systematic review. They tend to look more generally at the literature, and it doesn't aim to kind of look at every single article that could possibly exist on that topic. Mm-hmm. And it also doesn't necessarily kind of take a look at the quality or the rigor that's involved in the methodology. And I think that kind of opens it up more to get a diverse range of articles. And so it's it's like a review in that you pick out all these articles and you kind of look for themes and commonalities among them that maybe represents the experience of transgender people in the workplace, for example. So it's really to understand generally what the literature is saying with regards to that topic area, mm-hmm. rather than to provide like a critique of the literature. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I know I work with a university student in Southeast Asia a little bit, and mm-hmm. They are very eager to see your article, and I haven't had a chance to tell them yet about the podcast, but I'm sure listen to mm-hmm. the podcast as well. Is there anything that you would say to the clients out there that identify as a transgender person and are thinking about maybe using a career coach or counselor to try to navigate some of the issues in their lives?
Yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, I think.
And I didn't warn you about that one, so. Yeah, but,
okay.
Well, I should give you an extra moment, but we're running out of time.
No, that's okay. I think I would say that it's a huge step in going for career counseling, and I think it reflects a lot of strength and resilience to really take that first step and to go forward there. And certainly I hope they find the career counseling process to be supportive, and I hope their counselors do convey that they are supportive. And if they bump into one that's maybe not, then I hope they can find someone who is, because I think in this profession, it's integral and it's essential to be unconditionally supportive to clients and to genuinely care for them. So I really do hope that they can, and I'm sure they will find a counselor who, or a coach who will help them with that. So I certainly think it is possible. So.
Well, mm-hmm. I'm certain that after reading your article and listening to this podcast, people may mm-hmm. want to find you and follow your work. Are you on social media at all? Anything that you'd like to share on how people might learn more about you and the work that you're doing?
Oh, that's funny, because I actually don't have much in the way of social media, but I do have a Twitter.
There we go.
That I'm not super active on, but I'm always happy to talk to people on there. I'll just try and pull it up here. So it's the Twitter handle, I suppose, is DCLEFEBB. And that's it.
DCLEF?
EBV.
EBV.
Yeah.
DCLEFEBV.
Gotcha. Exactly.
Well, very good. Well, I just want to say, I mean, it is an act of, I think, some personal courage, but definitely an act of advocacy to simply do this work in a world where the work is not already always accepted. So thank you so much, Danielle, for what it is that you do, and
thank you
for helping educate our readership on such an important mm-hmm. topic.
Oh, thank you for that. Yeah, and thank you for, you know, allowing me to kind of convey this research and talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope everyone listened to and enjoyed our first podcast with Danielle Lefebvre. And Danielle, I did ask, what university are you at currently?
I'm at the University of Calgary.
The University of Calgary in Canada. And of course, following her on Twitter and watching her career journey as she does the good work, particularly in her focus on social justice and on working with transgender individuals.